I got a move anyway.
We're just
I'm not bored because they've left out my manufacturer guys.
Have you seen the threes?
You can never be me.
Oh, yeah, I heard of
them. Oh, yes.
What are you concerned about?
Okay.
Revenue.
Sound.
Spend more taxpayer money litigating their ordinance.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. It's Friday, April 17th.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which HB 3085 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Riley moves the rules be suspended for the purposes of reconsidering the vote by which House Bill 3085 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. The motion is not debatable. Cindy, will you call the roll?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Callan?
Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
Mr. Chair, I know it's not debatable, but I just need it repeated. I'm sorry.
The motion on the floor is to have the rules suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which House Bill 3085 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. The motion is,
Mr. Chair,
passes.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3085 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Riley moves to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3085 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes. I don't understand what we're doing, Mr. Chair.
Oh, why, Mr. Chair?
We are trying to reconsider House Bill 3085 because there was a mistake in the in a word on that bill, which was in the Dash One Amendment, and this was Representative Chris Edwards' bill on the local ordinance regulating manufactured dwelling park closures. So we're trying to reconsider, as the motion stated.
Mr. Chair, if I may help, Representative Tomei, it was the word before and after.
Thank you.
The wrong spot, correct?
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, there.
Obvious.
Good.
Any other discussion? Those of the opinion the committee should reconsider the vote will signify by saying aye as their name is called. Those opposed, no. Cindy, will you call the roll?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Callan?
Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye.
Mr. Chair.
The motion passes. I will open a work session on House Bill 3085.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair. I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which the committee adopted Dash 1 amendments dated 4309.
Representative Riley moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which the committee adopted the Dash 1 amendments dated 4309. The motion is not debatable. Cindy, will you call the roll?
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Callan.
Excused.
Representative Gilliam.
No.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Chair votes aye. The rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair,
I move we reconsider the vote by which the Dash 1 amendments dated 4309 were adopted.
Just a minute.
Four motion. This is always awkward.
Representative Riley moves to reconsider the vote by which the Dash 1 amendments dated 4309 were adopted. Is there any discussion?
Would you like me to make my motion now?
Not really.
Obviously.
There's a motion on the table.
I'm cool.
Any other discussion? Cindy, will you call the roll?
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Excuse.
Representative Gilliam.
No.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Toomey. Representative Winger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Chair votes aye. The motion carries, and the measure is once again before the committee in its original form.
Mr. Chair.
House Bill 3085 is carried over to Monday for a work session. I will now close the work session on House Bill 3085.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was fun.
I had to write it.
Yeah. I know.
Thank you, Representative Edwards. That was entertaining.
No, thank you.
Okay. So I'm going to recess for about a minute. going to reconvene the House Committee on Consumer Protection, and we
brought out the clerk.
I'll recess for one minute.
Something didn't.
America.
Oh, I'm going to reopen the Committee on Consumer Protection, and we will be carrying over, as previously announced, House Bill 3085, House Bill 2199, and House Bill 2189 for public hearing and work session to Monday. And notwithstanding that, we are going to continue our public hearing on House Bill 2189 today. So with that, I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2189.
So now you will close these for Monday.
Okay. And I can do it. So, first up, I'd like to have David Tapman and Paul Cosgrove. Mm-hmm. It is.
I'll listen to a little bit.
Thank you, gentlemen, and I'm going to have Mr. Tapman go first. Committee, as you recall, this bill's been before this committee before, and it's taken a great deal of time and effort to get amendments back before this committee on this important bill. And so what I would like to do is have Mr. Tapman start first, give us a brief summary of the bill, and then talk about the Dash 2 amendments. And then we will go to Mr. Cosgrove to talk to us about the Dash 5 amendments, and just to remind the committee about what this bill is about. Thank you, gentlemen. If you would introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, David Tapman, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I thank you for your attention on this Friday afternoon. As the Chair said, this is a very important matter for us. This bill is the bill by which we are attempting to implement the charge that Congress gave each and every state to come up with a licensing scheme for loan originators that make mortgage residential mortgage loans in each and every state. As you may recall, my testimony, I handed out written testimony last time, what was asserted under the Congressional Act, known as the SAFE Act, was that the states were to have made significant steps towards compliance with this in 2009, or the Department of the HUD, Housing and Urban Development, would take over that responsibility. And I think I can speak safely for both Mr. Cosgrove and other members of the United Financial Lobby. We all, including our office, feel that that would not be in the best interest of the consumers nor in the best interest of the various industries. So I think all of us implore this committee to recognize what the Chair said, and that is how important getting this through would be in whatever form it finally takes. The Dash 2s, which I hope you have before you, were created or drafted in an attempt to clarify a few things, in an attempt to make some adjustments. And what I've just handed out by way of your assistant to the committee is a summary of the major changes that were done. And I would like to just go through that rather than go through line by line of all 61 pages and read into the record each and every change. I don't think that serves any purpose. But what I would like to do is maybe touch on a few things and recognize that this is still a work in progress, and that this will not be a will not strike perfection. And I think all of you understand that the ability to make legislation on the fly, particularly given the limited or the tight time frames you and we are operating under, are rather challenging. We just received this late last night. We've been working on it all day. And this is just a quick draft. We may have missed something, and so if we do and someone catches that, we certainly would want to note that was by mistake, not by commission. I do want to say for the record, we have had conversations with the Oregon Bankers Association and just briefly with Mr. Cosgrove on behalf of the Oregon Financial Services Association. There is a provision in the Act, as we've proposed, to allow us to enforce four specific federal laws. In many of our financial regulatory schemes, we have broad general authority to enforce laws that are violated. We think that's sufficient. What we're going to do is go back yet again to legislative council in an attempt to put that in a format that clarifies that authority is sufficient, and we would probably come back and yet again amend and pull out those four specific federal references. But that's not in the dash twos. But I think that's an important piece because, I think that's something that stakeholders have asked for, and I have spoken with our general counsel at the Department of Justice, and they have confirmed that that power probably already exists. It just needs to be clarified. So having said that, then, with the indulgence of the committee, I will go through this list very briefly. So the amendments to 2189-1 that you previously had, they're now proposed in the dash 2. As you can see, we clarified the fact that loan processors and loan underwriters, those who are not loan originators because they're not engaged in negotiation or taking applications, would be exempt or excluded from the application of this new law. But we wanted to clarify that they are within the employment of certain entities. We want to avoid creating any type of carve-out for independent contractors, if you will. That's been a bugaboo of the industry for years, ever since the industry got licensed. And so we've clarified that in that very first box, if you will. Skipping down to the third one, Mr. Cosgrove raised the issue of loan servicers. We've attempted in the definitional section to pick up those that are strictly loan servicing on behalf of somebody who is a licensee of the department to exempt them from having to be licensed as a loan originator. Now, if you go down to the very next the next section, subsection 2 allows us by rule to exempt others. And I think there are a number of people who have come forward and spoken to members of this committee, including members of Mr. Cosgrove's group, members of the Manufactured Structured Dwelling Organizations, and recently Habitat for Humanity, who've all come forward and said, we think we should be outside the application of this law. That's probably appropriate, but we think it's best to try and do that by rule to make sure that we're coordinating with HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And so what we've done in Section 2 is give us the authority to go through rulemaking to exempt or exclude certain activities or certain persons engaged in certain activities from having to be licensed as a loan originator. Going down to the next one, Mr. Cosgrove raised the issue of interim licenses. The concern would be that as we get this new licensing system up, there may be a backlog. We don't want to put people in a position where they're already engaged in this conduct. They're already working as loan originators on behalf of essentially consumer finance lenders and others. If there was a backlog, we want to be able to address that. We don't think there'll be a backlog, but this new Section 3A gives us the authority to grant an interim license until the backlog is cleaned up. Section 4, again, another issue that Mr. Cosgrove brought up, and that was a question about using credit scores and credit reports. We've made several attempts at modifying that. We basically say we would not rely solely upon a credit report to deny somebody from licensing. I think that's reasonable and fair, and we would not be using credit scores to deny somebody. What we would hope is if somebody has a superior credit score, we would be able to use that as a justification to go forward with licensing, but we would never use the opposite, the negative or low score, to prohibit them. Section 4 is a request by the OAMP to keep us from investigating certain personal financial information of loan originators, and I think that's an effort to protect certain privacies. We're okay with that. I don't think we would ever get into people's personal taxes and the like, but we're happy to put that in the bill. Section 8, this came up in conversations with the committee last time when we were going through Sections 1. There was no reference to Chapter 183 of the ORS, the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act, so that's been included to be crystal clear, even though, as I said, I don't believe that's necessary because due process would require that, but it's in there again just to clarify and make sure that people are satisfied. Also in Section 8, we made an attempt to clarify how criminal cases could be referred or prosecuted. That, again, was in part due to the discussion. I'm not sure we got right to where we wanted to be, but it was an attempt to do that. And, again, it may be that that's sufficient to allow us to have further conversations either on this side of the Capitol or maybe on the other side if and when we get to the Senate. Section 9 is an important piece that was brought up in discussions that we had after the presentation of the Dash 1s, in which at that time the law or the bill required that the loan originators themselves get surety bonds. We don't think that's the better way to go. We think it's much better that the employers of the loan originators get the surety bonds. They're in a position, one, I think that they can probably do so more easily and probably at a better rate. And two, we think it's important that we do not create this independent contractor situation, which that could open the door to. So we've clarified that by saying that it is the employers of the loan originators that are to obtain the surety bond. And Mr. Cosgrove, although we have a typographical in the very last box at the bottom of the page, asked that we try and obtain additional information from the nationwide mortgage lending systems registry, and so we've added language to do just that. Should we be able to get information that's non-confidential, we could certainly share that with this committee or any other committee for that matter. And then on the back page, or on the back side of the page, we clarify that it's the loan originator's responsibility to provide all records and reports. It's the employer of the loan originator. Again, the loan originator is just an employee. We want the employer to be responsible for the oversight of that loan originator, and this is a critical and very important point to stress. And so we've changed it from the mortgage loan originator to the employer of the mortgage loan originator. I touched on the next box previously. We've added the anti-fraud provisions that are found in the mortgage lender law 59930. It essentially says that you can't knowingly engage in make material misrepresentations and material omissions. We think that's a critical piece for anybody that's engaged in this business. Some might argue that's inherent in their responsibility, but we want to make that very concrete and clear. So that's what Section 12, subsections 2 through 4 addresses. Section 12, subsection 7, there's a provision that says you may not collect a fee if you do not obtain a loan for somebody. That's been modified to indicate that should there be any fees that are passed down to the mortgage broker or the loan originator in the process of reviewing an application or negotiating an application, even though the loan is not successful, that those fees have to be paid. So, for instance, if somebody went out and got an appraisal and that appraisal costs roughly $400 and then there was no loan obtained, the loan originator or the mortgage lender should not be stuck with having to pay for that appraisal. That's not their cost of doing business. Make some minor changes to provisions regarding the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. Again, some changes at the request of the OAMP, making sure that there's some materiality, if you will, around the prohibition on false and deceptive statements. That is consistent with what I just said. We've tried to clarify in sections 14 to use the same definition that's in this new 2189 in chapter 59 because they're comparably the same. So certain attorneys are carved out from having to get licensed, and we just want to use the same language so we don't get whipsawed between two different definitions of carve-outs for attorneys. And then section 23, which I'm sure we'll be discussing at some length later on, is an amendment to clarify that the private right of action is applicable to any consumer who has feels they've been aggrieved by a residential mortgage loan originator, regardless of who employs that loan originator. And so those are the major changes. I'm happy to go into more detail. I don't know if that's beneficial at this point. I think it's, with all due respect, I'd defer back to the committee and probably have Mr. Cosgrove address his issues and then maybe have a discussion.
Yeah, certainly it's fine. I think maybe we would, maybe if there's questions for you at this point, I think we'll have those and then listen to Mr. Cosgrove on the next set of amendments. So, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tapman, thanks for being here on a Friday afternoon and bringing several amendments.
The one I'm concerned about, and it's, I think, is...
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gilliam, I'm just bringing one amendment.
Sorry. Many aspects to one amendment. Follow up. I guess I got kind of goofed up there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Follow up.
Thank you. In the various points of the amendment, I don't see one for one that I was hoping would be there. Am I missing it? It's one for manufactured housing dealers. Are they included in, like, I saw the first one, possibly that would exempt them?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Representative Gilliam, what we want to do, and this is what I mentioned earlier around manufactured structured dwelling dealers, as well as the Habitat for Humanity, and for those people who are servicers that are not employees of those people licensed with us, we would like to address that by rule. And we think what that would allow us to do is give HUD time to address this. What we're told by Mr. Miner and others is that HUD has not weighed in yet. There are some states that have gone out, if you will, in their own direction, but they're very few. Most states have deferred to the way HUD's addressed this. HUD has not officially, Housing and Urban Development, the department thereof, has not officially addressed that. What this would do would allow us to have a rulemaking sometime this summer, with the implementation date is next year. So I think that gives us plenty of time. Nobody is at jeopardy of having to get licensed between now and April of 2010, and that should allow us to address it. And I think by rule is the better way to do it than rather than try and guess and then get sideways with HUD, if you will. But that's my recommendation.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Okay, but what my problem is, it seems straightforward. I mean, if you have to wait for HUD, you got to wait for HUD. But if you're not getting any compensation, why can't a dealer be exempted? Is it not that straight up?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilliam, as the definition of mortgage originator, loan mortgage originator stands right now, it talks about compensation, but compensation isn't defined. What I would propose to do is define that in rule and say that compensation that we're talking about is compensation in conjunction with making a loan, not compensation in conjunction with making a chattel sale. But right now, compensation is just this broad brush. And so my recommendation is let us address it just that way. My concern is I can't possibly anticipate all the different people that could come up with different theories of arguments that they're compensated one way, which takes them outside of what was really intended to be covered. I'd much rather try and use a very fine scalpel than a very broad brush in statute. Obviously I have a lot of faith in our ability to get where we need to be. And I think I've talked with Mr. Miner at some length about this and have indicated that our goal is not to bring people in that don't need to be regulated, but our goal is to make sure that those people that are engaged in taking and negotiating, right now it's just taking an application. That's very broad. We would like to be able to say if you take an application and get compensated for taking that application as opposed to having sold the underlying chattel, that would be, you would get licensed for taking the application and passing it on versus not getting compensated. But that would probably be a better thing to do by rule, if you would.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I would just say, I don't need to follow up, but just for the record, I have a lot of faith in this department and in Mr. Tapman. He has been our friend in this committee many times. Having said that, at this stage, with a bill this technical and voluminous, I'm not comfortable with the old standbys. I'm not attributing this to Mr. Tapman, of let's fix it on the other side, or we'll do it by rule. I think if we can, and Mr. Miner's not here, I think if we can, we ought to address it now while we're still open. So I wanted to note that for the record.
And thank you. I think I'll add something to that. I talked to Mr. Miner today about that, and I recognize his concerns, and I've talked to Mr. Tapman about those, but at the same time, it's pretty hard to exempt and from my take on this anyway, it seems pretty difficult to exempt manufactured housing in their entirety with a fell swoop too, because there may be, especially after HUD decides what specific practices may or may not constitute being a loan originator, it's pretty hard to say that everybody in that industry should be exempt. There may be a couple of people that operate in that industry that may in fact be loan originators, and the rest of them may be exempt. So it's pretty hard. I think the doing it by rule is the only way we can set this up at this point, from my perspective. And
well, if you're confident that they'll, you know, exempt those that aren't receiving, whoever they are, may not be, then it makes me feel more comfortable.
Well, it's certainly something that I think we have to have some direction from HUD on as well, you know. So I really appreciate the fact that, you know, we're trying to make sure that we're as compliant and consistent with the SAFE Act and the HUD decisions as we can. And I think having that flexibility in rule is actually pretty critical to being able to do that. But certainly it'd be nice if everything was always just cut and dry and black and white, but it's extremely important that I believe the state of Oregon is able to do the enforcement under the SAFE Act as the federal government is looking to states to be compliant with their new requirements. So,
Mr. Chair, if I may just add one comment, and I don't know if this will assuage some of the Representative Gilliam's concerns or not, but we have a weekly telephone conference call with the vast majority, if not all 50 states, and state industry representative groups, and HUD, to discuss all these issues. And this has been an ongoing conversation, and I know Mr. Miner and his national organization have been pushing very hard on this. We have raised this issue. We recognize that HUD, I think, candidly, in my opinion, is overwhelmed with all they're trying to accomplish with this. I think in time, and as I said, I think we have the better part of the rest of this year to get there, HUD will address some of these things. Ironically, HUD is the federal regulator for the manufactured structured dealers industry, and so they're very much aware of what they do. So it would strike me that, if anything, they're going to address this particular issue, and then we should be able to pick up by rule during the interim between sessions the very concept that they land at. And that would be ideal. Now, if not, as I say, I think we can address most of these issues around the definition of compensation. But as I said, we've got Habitat for Humanity, who engages in technically meeting the definition, but we probably don't need them to get licensed, but there might be circumstances where we do. And we have certain loan servicers who we feel we want to promote loan servicers who are negotiating or renegotiating and modifying loans as we speak. As you know, that's a big issue for the federal government. So the opportunity to try and come up with something that is broad enough to meet all those different circumstances would be far superior, I think, than trying to have minute, discrete pieces within this bill, and then you'd end up with a laundry list of different carve-outs, which becomes problematic in terms of how it matches up with other states. And that's all I'll say about this.
Mr. Chair, if I might, just one quick follow-up.
Representative Gilliam,
I would say thank you for that answer, and I take you at your word. I do have a lot of respect for the work that you do. But just remember, these three phrases do not make me feel better. Fix it on the other side. Fix it by rule. And I'm from the federal government. I'm here to help.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I at the risk of belaboring the point, I actually think that Representative Gilliam's concerns, for once, are in this quite valid and appropriate. I think in a 61-page bill, it's not wholly onerous or unreasonable to try and define compensation, and to the extent there might be carve-outs. And yes, that definition could potentially be supplemented by a rule later. But having something there in place would make me feel more comfortable as well. In addition, it's my understanding that we're not planning to move this today, that there is some time. I don't view this as necessarily a huge carve-out or a huge amendment, and I think it's not unreasonable.
Thank you, Representative Barton. I appreciate your comments as well, and I think that I guess I would just ask Mr. Tapman, is it the department's intention to be consistent with the HUD definitions when they do come out with them?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, that would be our intention. I think that the more we stray from what is expected at the federal level, the more we run the risk of having someone step in and saying, you didn't meet our expectations. So, yes, we would definitely do that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Cosgrove, welcome to the House Committee on Consumer Protection this afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Appreciate your time. On behalf of the my name is Paul Cosgrove, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Financial Services Association, and there are two major categories of employees who originate mortgage loans that are covered by the SAFE Act and state licensing. Those who are employees of mortgage bankers and brokers who we have licensed as a state for some time, and those employed by consumer finance companies, although you have also heard that they're potentially mobile or manufactured structure people who might be brought in or not brought in, depending on how HUD rules. So we are the other major interested party. And I would like to express first my appreciation for Mr. Tapman and his staff. We brought, and when I testified before you before, I had a number of substantive concerns about servicers and interim licenses. And although in our negotiations with the department, there were a number of issues in which we did not reach agreement or couldn't get the language we wanted, we believe that the department has gone a long way, and we appreciate the changes they've made on the summary. So the only thing I'm here to talk about is the issue of enforcement penalties. And the Dash 5s are identical to the Dash 2s except for three areas. And so I'd only like to point out what those three areas are. And I mentioned this the last time I testified, and this is the issue on which we've not reached agreement with the department. First of all, if you look at the Dash 5s on page 13, the current proposal in the Dash 2s is for civil penalties of $25,000 and the ability to refer for criminal prosecution for what I believe under ORS 59992 is up to a Class C felony. Our companies, if we make violations of our licensing statute, which has all sorts of provisions in it about not defrauding people and having licenses and keeping good records, are subject to penalties of $2,500. We don't think our employees should be subject to penalties that are 10 times larger than our companies are, nor to criminal prosecution. So in the Dash 5s on page 13, we've proposed that our employees be subject to the same civil penalties as our companies are, and nothing more. That's change one. Change two is on page 21. And Mr. Tapman has mentioned that there are several places in this bill, and they may be modified based on the discussions he said he's having with the bankers and with us about their ability to enforce federal law. But what I'm talking about right now on page 21 of the Dash 5s is the provisions that are in the Dash 2s that you won't see in the Dash 5s, where the department has proposed to be able to enforce federal law against our employees. Like, for example, the Truth in Lending Act. The Truth in Lending Act is a disclosure provision. Our companies have forms that have disclosures, and our companies' computers calculate APRs and other kinds of things, and our companies have procedures to give rights of rescission notices, etc. If one of our employees makes a mistake in that regard, certainly we're liable, and consumers can sue us, and the department can use its enforcement authority against us. Frankly, if one of our employees does that for very often, they probably won't be our employee for very long, but we don't think that the department should or needs to have the ability to seek penalties against our employees for what they may have been involved in passing out a paper that had the wrong APR on it, as an example. So we have eliminated the provisions that say the department can enforce those federal laws against our employees. They most certainly can enforce them against us, and we stand liable for what our employees have done in those regards. That's change two. And the last one, change three, is reflected on changes on both page 14 and page 40.
Mr. Cosgrove, can you go back just a moment? I'm trying to catch up with that last change.
Sure.
It was on page 25?
It's on page 21.
21, that's what I couldn't find it.
And the problem is what I'm pointing at is to something you're not seeing. So maybe I should point to where it is in the dash 2s and where it's not in the dash 5s. And so you can see what has been taken out. Because that's the difference, is the removal of a section from the dash 2s. And if you look at the dash 2s on page 21 of the dash 2s at line 11, subsection 12, it says one of the violations is failure to conduct business as a mortgage loan originator, that means our employee, in compliance with the provisions of the Truth in Lending Act, the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and one other federal statute. Those are all current requirements that our companies have to comply with, but we don't think that violation of those should give a enforcement right against our employees, but just against our company. So we have removed that in the dash fives. And again, as an example, the kinds of things we're talking about here are disclosure provisions that if the consumer receives the wrong disclosures, it's probably our computer's problem, or it may have been that they put in the wrong figure, but that's something that we think we should stand liable for, not our employees. Same with RESPA. There are certain disclosures that are required at certain timelines. We're happy to stand liable for those violations. We are liable for those violations. We just don't think our employees should be. Does that answer your question, Mr. Chair?
It does. I was just on the wrong page, so I was having trouble following you.
I'm sorry. I apologize for that. The third and last difference between the twos and the fives is provisions that are on page 40 of the dash fives. And I'll describe it generally, and then I'll show you how it's different by referring to how it's different in the dash 2. On page 40 in the dash 5s, this is a current provision of law that applies to mortgage brokers. And on the dash 2s, ORS 59.925 has been amended to provide a private right of action against our companies, although the original version you saw also said our employees. We can be sued by our consumers if we breach contract. We can be sued by our consumers if we act negligently in closing their loan, and we can be sued if we act fraudulently. And nothing that we do in this bill will change that. We don't think it makes sense, and it's never been the policy of the department to pursue creation of a remedy until this bill against one of its licensed financial institutions, one of its lenders, that provides that individual consumers can sue us for licensing violations. What we have always had is the department enforces licensing violations. They can issue cease and desist orders. They can issue penalties if the licensing violations are too great. They can yank our license, but that's not been a consumer remedy historically against any of the department's lenders. And by that I mean not against consumer finance companies, not against banks, not against credit unions. We don't believe it should be a remedy here. It is a remedy the department has against mortgage brokers, but that's been for some time, and that was a bill that the mortgage brokers brought to you, this body, a number of years ago. We just don't think it should be expanded against lenders. There's a difference between the activities of a mortgage broker and a lender, and we have ongoing liability to our consumers because we're in a day-to-day collecting a loan and having a loan and taking payments. We have lots of remedies for consumers. None of these changes that I am asking for are things that are required under the Federal SAFE Act. These are things that this bill is being used as a vehicle to make changes in the liability of our employees and our companies. And we don't think they're either necessary nor appropriate. And in fact, I will report to you that one of our members, who's a small local company, and doesn't make a lot of mortgage loans, so I'm not proposing here that this is going to make a great difference to the world of lending. But with respect to that company, they've taken a look at what would be imposed on them under the dash 2s in terms of liability to their employees and the difficulty they'd have keeping and retaining good employees, and the liability potentially to their company for civil suits against them by consumers for licensing violations, and they'd said, we couldn't possibly make mortgage loans. Now, they don't make many at the moment. They make a few, but they couldn't possibly risk that potential liability that's being proposed in the Dash 2s. And so that's why we are proposing the changes, those three changes I mentioned in the Dash 5s. As I say, there are other issues that we had discussed. We're willing to live with all the resolution of those other issues in the Dash 2. We won some, we lost some, but nonetheless, the Dash 2 is otherwise acceptable to us. The Dash 5 just deals with those three penalty and enforcement issues. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and I appreciate, and I know you haven't had a lot of time to look this over or anything, but I think I would appreciate if over the weekend you could send the committee an email with those three pieces specifically and stating your issues with those. I think it might be helpful. Not that I'm asking my committee to work on the weekend to look at those things, but I just would like them to have those things available to them Monday morning on your three specific pieces where you're not in complete agreement with the Dash 2s. I think that would be helpful for us.
I will, Mr. Chairman, and I point out that the Dash 5s are otherwise intended to be exactly identical word to word to the Dash 2s, and as I've mentioned to Mr. Tatman, as we all read them this weekend, if we find there are any other differences, they were not intended, and we'll make sure they get corrected. But otherwise, those are the three substantive differences that are supposed to be there, and I will lay them out in writing for them.
And you notice I didn't ask my committee to work on the weekend, but maybe I did ask you. Oh, it's not 5 o'clock yet. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sort of used to it, as I think you are sometimes, too.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cosgrove, I have questions regarding, I guess you mentioned three issues. I have questions regarding the third, and then also, Mr. Chair, I have some questions regarding the first issue. Regarding the third, which was the cause of action on page 4041.
Correct.
As I look at it, so first of all, I do understand your point, but even still, in order for a potential plaintiff to state a claim, they'd also have to prove causation and damages. And the provisions there, essentially, which concededly are part of from the license, I mean, a plaintiff would still have to prove causation and damages. It would be, it's actually, as causes of action come and go, probably not all that useful. I think it would be very hard to state and prevail a claim. And I'm wondering if, A, you agree with that, and, B, if so, why your members are so concerned about it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, yes, I think every cause of action requires causation, but the concern is that there would be a number of additional claims or new claims that might be filed that could be at least asserted in good faith in a court of law. That you, as well as I know, that not winning a lawsuit is not necessarily always the biggest problem. It's having a lawsuit filed against you. That's one issue. But more importantly, I think, consumers have and will continue to have and should have the ability to sue us for things that we've done wrong. We see, as you pointed out, there may be very few claims that could be stated in good faith under this, but if so, why have it here? I mean, if consumers can sue us for breach of contract,
right,
and for negligence and for fraud, why would you want to have a provision that causes concern and risk? Businesses are risk averse. When they see a new cause of action against them, it makes them very nervous, and they have to evaluate whether that potential set of claims that could be filed against them, what that risk is. And what my members are saying is this puts a whole new element of risk that has never been involved in any of our state licensing statutes against lenders before. It has been against mortgage brokers, but not against lenders, and that causes some great concern.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I read it, essentially, for a potential plaintiff to assert a claim under this, it would have to be conduct in order for it to cause damages, probably tantamount to fraud anyway. I don't view this as being actually an unreasonable claim. This provision, your third point, at least speaking for myself only, does not cause me great concern, with all due respect, Mr. Cosgrove. If I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn to his first point.
Follow up, Representative Barton.
Thank you. Which was on page 13.
Correct.
And Actually, would you be so kind as to refresh my recollection in precisely what it was? I believe it was essentially you wanted it to... You essentially wanted to drop a zero on line 14. Am I oversimplifying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, slightly oversimplifying. What the dash fives are is it provides that the same existing civil penalty authority against mortgage brokers of $25,000 continues against mortgage brokers, loan originators, because that's their issue, not my issue. But that with respect to the loan originators who are employed by consumer finance companies, if you look on the dash fives, page 13, line 19, it says the director may impose a civil penalty for violations of mortgage loan originator employed by a Chapter 725 licensee. That's my clients. Only in accordance with the provisions of ORS 725910. If I would wish that that had been incorporated here so you could see it, but I can assert to you that 725910 allows civil penalties up to $2,500 against our companies for violations like this,
mm-hmm.
and we're proposing that the amount of civil penalty available for violations by our employees be the same, not greater. So in one sense, you are correct. It reduces to zero. It makes our employees the same as our company. But the other thing it does, and this is why it wasn't quite the same, is it does not permit criminal prosecution referrals for violations by our employees, which is now permitted with respect to mortgage brokers, has never been permitted with respect to us or our employees. This is the Class C felony issue that you remember.
Mr. Cosgrove, I mean, I'm following you there, but why would we treat one loan originator with the mortgage brokers, you know, differently than loan originators in your lending institution? It seems like, especially the way the federal government is going with this whole regulation over loan originators, over all loan originators, it seemed like we would want to be consistent across the board with the way we treat them for penalties.
Mr. Chair, there are several ways to look at the infamous level playing field issue, which is often brought before you and discussed in this committee. The playing field is not level now. The functions and roles of a mortgage broker who creates a loan but doesn't fund it with their own money versus a lender which creates and funds a loan are significantly different, and we've never treated them the same. We don't now treat them the same. I guess if you're looking at consistency, the consistency I would urge you is it doesn't make sense to treat our employees as subject to penalties 10 times greater than their employers for exactly the same conduct. And that's the consistency that we would prefer. And you think of it from the perspective of our employees. They are, for the first time, going to be licensed under this provision. That's going to cause them concern. They are, for the first time, having to go through a whole series of things, including criminal records checks, which, frankly, we often do before we hire them as well, and we don't think we have hired people who have criminal backgrounds. But there are lots of burdens on them, and to add to those burdens by saying that they might be subject to civil penalties 10 times greater than their employer for essentially licensing violations, I think causes them concern and causes us concern as their employers. Are we going to be able to keep and retain those employees? It's a major potential liability, and it didn't seem fair to us that it should be heavier on them than it is on us.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm winding up, don't worry. And at the risk of being inconsistent...
How do you wind down?
To the extent I was... I suppose fairly dismissive of Mr. Cosgrove's third concern. Regarding his first concern here, I'm more sympathetic. And really, I suppose your first concern has two subparts, A and B. First, regarding civil liability of employees. Second, regarding criminalization of it. And I think both are at least give me pause. I can't say I've yet reached a conclusion on that, but that is something I'm going to consider quite a bit over the weekend. It won't be a fun weekend.
Mr. Tatman, would you care to comment on this discussion? I know you've been sitting there listening.
Mr. Chair, just a few comments, and I realize time is precious and you have others to hear from, so I will try and be brief. One, with regard to the issue that Representative Barton brought up about civil liability, as he said, there is an issue of causation, but there's also an issue of damages, meaning that the person has to be hurt. You'd have to establish the fact that somebody failed to get their continuing education was a direct result in the person getting hurt. So I don't think that we're creating a really wide-open hole that people are going to be punished for. I think it comes back to that. I will say there's a distinction between the fraud provisions that Mr. Cosgrove's talking about and the fraud provisions that are found in Chapter 59. There is a much higher standard for fraud than for traditional common law fraud than there is under Chapter 59. And we do that because it's so important that consumers are not given deliberate misrepresentations. I think it's important that that also apply to other loan originators, particularly those that are consumer finance lenders as well as our mortgage lenders. So I think that is a consistent area, and I would urge this committee to maintain that consistency. With regard to the fine, I have to tell you $2,500 in 2009 is to my way, outrageous. If I was even had been thinking about this, we would probably have addressed that in 725, Chapter 725, the consumer finance section, to bring those fines up to be reflective of the fines that we have in our other programs. $2,500 in this day and age is ridiculously low. I would not disagree that the individuals should not be charged 10 times as much as the company should be, but my recommendation would be is to change 725 to make the fines be meaningful. The purpose behind a fine is to be something more than the cost of doing business, to get someone's attention. And at $2,500, my recommendation is that doesn't get it done. I don't disagree with that. Lastly, I think it's important, and this was really, we're very genteel here, but this is where Mr. Cosgrove and I disagree. I think this requirement that the federal government said everyone that makes a loan has to be licensed is a new paradigm, and we have to stop thinking about the way it used to be. We're saying everyone that makes a loan originator has to be licensed. That license means that you have certain responsibilities and duties that you haven't had historically, and there's a level of accountability that you haven't had in the past. And we're going to hold our mortgage lender loan originators to that level of accountability, and I think our consumer finance lender should be held to that same level of accountability. And if that means criminal prosecution, I think that's appropriate. And if it means civil liability, the reality is if a loan originator gets sued, it's not the loan originator that gets sued, it's the company that gets sued. And so the loan originator is not even going to be subject to the suit. We were very careful as Mr. Cosgrove pointed out, we originally had the loan originators in, we took them out because we thought it was more fair to make it just the company itself. So I think we've addressed most of what Mr. Cosgrove's brought up, but I think some of it is just a philosophical difference that this committee is going to have to decide.
Mr. Chair, may I briefly respond?
The debate? Mr. Cosgrove.
It may be because it's late on a Friday afternoon, but to say that a $2,500 fine is outrageous is absolutely inconsistent with the history of the regulation of our industry. As Mr. Tatman knows, there was no proposal to change, and never has been a proposal by the department, to increase the penalties on our companies because we have a very good track record. And yes, it's a new paradigm. The feds have said our folks will be licensed. Other states are not changing the penalties as they are imposing a licensing regime. Washington is not changing the penalties on our employees as it imposes this same regime. Neither is California. It is a gratuitous addition to the bill. It's an unnecessary addition to the bill. It's not based on conduct or problems or history of conduct or problems. And it, I think, is an unfair one with respect to our employees and with respect to our licensees. And that's all I'd say. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Barton, I thought you were winding
down. I know, I thought I was too.
You were winding up. Now can you wind down?
Sorry, Mr. Chair. It strikes me that because essentially in this kind of points A and B, civil and then criminal, that at the risk of being Solomonic and splitting the baby, that there's compromise available, such as... You, frankly, Mr. Cosgrove, you seem most concerned by the $25,000 civil potential liability. Perhaps if I were one of your clients, potential Class C felony for any violation of this statute strikes me as it would frighten me. And It seems that one, we could do one, but not the other, at least. It just seems that there's a lot of potential for middle ground between you two.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, $25,000 to one of our employees is a very big deal, a very, very big deal. Frankly, $2,500 to one of our employees is a very big deal. Yes, Class C felonies is probably a bigger deal, but I don't think to say that there's a distinction there. It's from, like, very high to extraordinarily high big deal. Both are extraordinarily
difficult. I think that point's been made to us, so Representative Widener, you have a quick comment, because I'd like to get some other testimony in here and get out of here on a Friday. So, Representative Widener, please, your question.
Let's move.
Oh, no. If you got a question, I want you to get it on
the record.
Go.
Just going to ask Mr. Tapman, $2,500 for an employee, you don't think is a substantial high enough fine?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Widener, that's the maximum, and it's not about the employee, it's about the violation. If a violation is egregious, I think $2,500, there are traffic tickets that are now over $1,000. So I don't think this is a traffic ticket, I think it's something more substantial. $25,000 is the maximum. I can give you chapter and verse this number of times we impose penalties, and typically the penalties are somewhere in the range of $2,000 to $5,000, whether it's a company or an individual. But I think it's critical that we have the ability to be able to make the violation, if you will, the sanctions fit the crime. And if somebody has violated numerous times, I think a $2,500 penalty for a third time offense is awfully low and sends the wrong message. And so, yes, within there's a range, and I realize there are members of this committee that don't believe that you can trust us to exercise our discretion, but for 20 years we've been exercising our discretion and have done a reasonable job of not maximizing out our penalties. But it gives us a way to move upward if we have continuing or ongoing violations or certain violations that are egregious and certain that aren't. It's a part of the toolbox that regulators use, and I think if you limit them to a small amount, then there's only so much they can do to get someone's attention. And I realize the disparity, as we kind of beat this to death, between the company and the individual, and I think that needs to be reconciled. How it gets reconciled is maybe the difference between Mr. Cosgrove and myself.
Thank you. Representative
Wiener. Quick question. I just was hoping, sir, you'd identify for me who in the dais you believe doesn't trust you.
Oh, no, I've heard that there's concerns. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Winger. Nobody in general, I've just heard concerns.
That joke fell.
I'm sorry, what?
It was a Friday joke.
I missed it. I guess, is that a question to be answered? Or should
No.
You're completely fine. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate your testimony, and I appreciate all the work both of you have done in trying to get us a bill that's as in good a shape as it is at this point in time. I'm really, quite frankly, pleased with the product that we have before us to consider. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, I have Tom Hendrickson. I thought it was Todd.
No, I passed this time.
Oh.
Hendrickson.
Okay. Thank you. And I'll let you go ahead, and hopefully you can.
Thank you, Chairman Holby. If you don't mind, I'm going to be rather brief.
No, I don't mind at all. Thank you. If you identify yourself for the record.
My name is Tom Hendrickson, Thomas R. Hendrickson. I'm Executive Vice President and one of the principal owners of Associated Mortgage Group in Portland. I'm also the current president of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, and for the record, a past president of the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association, now Oregon Mortgage Lenders. I also served for the last 2 years as one of 12 people on the National Mortgage Advisory Committee to the Conference of State Banking Supervisors and the American Association of Mortgage Regulators in implementing and drafting model legislation for the implementation of the SAFE Act nationwide. So it's been a very big part of my life the last couple of years. And I would say of many people people within our association. We are very proud of the relationship we have with our regulators, and we've worked closely and well with Mr. Tapman's office at the division. We've been involved at every step of the way in meetings, numerous meetings, back and forth in Salem, in between Portland and Salem and other areas, and these meetings have been going on for really for almost 2 years, and more intensely over the last 6 months. So I'm here to support House Bill 2189-2. It's not a perfect piece of legislation. It's probably not entirely done yet. There's a couple little housekeeping things that need to be done, and our people will be working with Mr. Tapman's people, but nothing of real substance. We're talking about perhaps making some of the definitions in the bill more closely match the SAFE Act itself and or the model legislation that HUD has already approved. HUD is the enforcing body, and it's important that we keep the legislation that we have as close as possible to the model legislation, because we've already been told by HUD that if you do that, if you substantially have the model bill, which we substantially do have, with a couple of Oregonian tweaks, but that's fine, then we should have HUD's blessing. What we don't want to have is have a situation where we're not able to pass legislation, and then HUD comes in and we would become perhaps even embarrassingly the only state where the federal government would be the mortgage regulators, which would only happen if we don't have implementation of this legislation. So I don't know that I need to speak more at this point, other than the fact that that we thank the people we've worked with. We thank our own people for all the efforts, hundreds and hundreds of hours that have been put in over the last couple of years on this, and I would be happy to respond to any questions that you, Chairman Hovey, or any member of the committee has.
I certainly appreciate you coming down and testifying, and I wish all my committee members were here to hear your testimony, because I think it's a pretty critical one, because I think this piece of legislation is perhaps one of the most important pieces that this committee is dealing with this session.
I stated that, Chair Hovey, at the last time I spoke. I think it's the most important piece of mortgage-related legislation to come before this committee in the last at least three or four sessions. And it's absolutely critical. We don't have to go back and tell all the wonderful things it does. I remember at the last session, Representative Tomei kidded me a little about my excessive enthusiasm, but it was there's reason to be enthusiastic. It really is good for the consumer, and we appreciate your support.
I'm curious, as you've listened to the discussion between Mr. Cosgrove and Mr. Tapman, if you have any positions one way or another on the disagreement areas.
We recognize areas where Mr. Cosgrove and his group sees are important specifically to them. I think we're in support of 2189-2 generally. I would have to say in support of Mr. Tapman's people. The discussion came up as to the $2,500, and if anything, fortunately, I've never been associated with, my company's never been associated with any kind of enforcement proceeding by the state and related to any functions we've done with mortgage lending, nor have we ever been sued by a consumer in any function relating to mortgage lending and the thousands of people we've helped. But in my capacity and because of my general interest, I go through, you can actually, it's public record, go on the website and look at all the actions that have been taken by Mr. Tapman's division over the years. And if anything, I think that they've been awfully lenient. I think that they've been, if anything, if they've erred, they may have erred on being too lenient, so I think worried about them being maybe carried away and making excessive charges would be, at least for the current people who have been involved now, would be totally unfounded.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Any other questions? Comments?
I'm sorry I didn't make the town hall meeting.
I missed you.
I was actually meeting with another pair of first-time homebuyers doing their loan application that day. So, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Next up, could I have Scott Berry? Welcome, Mr. Berry. I appreciate you waiting, and I know you have a couple comments to make for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On behalf of Habitat for Humanity, I will be brief. Just a couple of quick comments. From our understanding, we believe the SAFE Act applies just to those individuals who work with mortgages for compensation or gain. That's language in the SAFE Act. Habitat for Humanity carries all of their own loans. They are all zero interest loans. They are made with no fees, and they receive and they pass along no fees to the person who involved the partners that they work to ensure can get into these houses. So I don't. Obviously, we are interested in an exemption from this for the individual affiliates and organizations around the state that that try to get folks into their first house. And so, I think our interest is in following what at least one or two other states have done, and that is exempting these nonprofits from the SAFE Act. So, with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I just didn't want to get that on the record.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I know you listened carefully to the testimony about trying to address many of these things by rule and trying to be their intention of being consistent with the HUD definitions. So I hope that offers you a little bit of comfort going forward. But I appreciate your comments and your concerns. Any questions?
Just before
Representative Riley.
Before he goes, if he could state his name for the record, which he fails to do.
Again, Scott Berry, representing Habitat for Humanity.
Thank you. Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And it seems like we're awfully close between these -2, -5. Seems like, and that's great. I guess I'm curious, in terms of the -2, it says by rule. Are you in favor of that? Are you opposed to that? Or what is your preference? I'm just kind of trying to get a feel for where you're at for Habitat for Humanity.
Sure. Chair Holby, Representative Matthews. I've worked with agencies for a number of years, and I know that in almost every case, when something's talked about on the record that they're going to do by rule, that almost always occurs. However, I can't find any possible reason any way to define for compensation or gain that would apply to Habitat for Humanity and what they do, given the product they're offering their partners.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Next up, I have Angela Martin and Sybil Head and Matt Wallace.
Mr. Chair, I believe Sybil have had to leave, so you have Matt and I.
Okay, and if you can be brief, it would be great. I have commitments in a few minutes.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, glad to be brief. My name is Angela Martin with Our Oregon. Coming here to testify in support of House Bill 2189-2. Want to focus my comments on the question of access to justice, in particular the difference between the -5s and the -2s, as represented by Mr. Cosgrove's point number 3. You'll see that testimony was also submitted to you by an attorney, consumer law attorney Phil Goldsmith. I'm going to reflect briefly on that. A few points to bear in mind. During the housing boom, most families who obtained subprime loans relied on the services of a mortgage broker. We know that upwards of 70% of loans in the subprime market during those peak years, people relied on the services, the reliability, the expertise of a mortgage broker. What those homeowners didn't understand is the distinction between a mortgage broker licensed under Chapter 59 versus Chapter 725 when it comes to asserting their rights if they're ever cheated or the law was broken. Now, to be clear, we recognize that doesn't happen often. Fortunately, it is the rarity that a homeowner is defrauded. But when that damage is visited upon a homeowner, we certainly feel that they need to have access to the court system. To that point, Mr. Cosgrove mentioned that consumers have the ability to sue under Chapter 725. They can sue those companies. We define ability a little bit differently, and if you'll look at Phil Goldsmith's testimony, I think the point is made very clear. If a consumer does not have the ability to recover attorney fees, going to court is simply not going to be possible. Attorney fees that run into the thousands and thousands of dollars in order to recover damages that may only amount to what attorney fees would normally be is not an effective enforcement, is actually a deterrent to enforcement of this law. In Mr. Goldsmith's testimony, you'll see that since the year 2000, his firm opened up 25 cases against Chapter 725 mortgage originators, and only brought cases forth on two of those, and that is because those cases triggered a TILA violation. Under a TILA violation, he was able to, he knew that he would be able to get attorney fees. Those other cases did not proceed to court. Some of them because they just didn't have the facts in place, they didn't warrant a case to move forward. Others because he had to explain to the homeowner that we can take your case to court, but it's likely that you won't recover enough to cover the fees, the cost of going to court. Simply not worth it to him. The other point I want to make is that allowing all consumers who utilize the services of a mortgage originator to have their day in court if they are violated won't lead to an explosion of frivolous lawsuits. We simply have to look to Chapter 59 licensees that currently have a private right of action in it. People like Mr. Hendrickson, who explains he has never been sued. Frivolous lawsuits simply have not been the result of an effective private right of action. It's hard to understand why it would be the case that frivolous lawsuits would be the reaction if all homeowners had that access. With that, I'll close and say thank you for your time and work on this issue.
Thank you. Mr. Wallace.
Sure. Well, Chair Hovey, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to weigh in today. I thought I had till 5, but I suppose if I cut, you know, a few things, I can probably... I'm just joking entirely. I just want to make one point.
About ready to close the hearing.
Sure. I'll keep it to one point. Thank you for the opportunity. We do want to weigh in support of the Dash 2s.
And your name is?
Oh, for the record, Matt Wallace with Osberg. Thank you. Again, want to weigh in to support of the Dash 2s, and just want to make one point under that. I think as Mr. Cosgrove and Mr. Tatman both mentioned in their testimony, this is a new era of the licensing of mortgage loan originators. We have new requirements that apply across the board, whether they're licensed under Chapter 725 or under Chapter 59 in terms of background checks, annual licensing fees, and the like. The list goes on a little bit. Our major concern between the two is simply that we, of course, apply those standards and the enforcement of those standards evenly across the industry. And with respect, what I heard from Mr. Cosgrove's testimony was that, you know, we haven't treated the employees of their companies like this before, but I didn't hear a lot in terms of really why we shouldn't, especially given the place that we're in as a result of in many ways, a lack of regulation of the mortgage lending industry at large over the last several years. So I will leave my comments to that, and certainly just echo, you know, that a reasonable penalty and a reasonable ability to sue and even criminal prosecution does not at all seem unreasonable when those violations happen and when action under those violations are warranted. And I'll leave it there.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward and voicing your opinions on the bill, and I don't see any questions. And with that, no one else is signed up. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2189? Not seeing any. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2189. And just as a reminder, committee, I am carrying these House Bill 2199 and House Bill 3085 over to Monday. And with that, committee, have a good weekend. Thank you for your attention. And I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection. Thanks, John.